Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
It is Brett King. I am the host. I've been doing this for a while. This is our 300th episode for Breaking Banks. We started back in May 2013, so that's 6.5 years in the making. 300 episodes, of course, means 300 hours every week, rain, hail, or shine. Now, I haven't done all of the episodes. We've got some great co-hosts that are going to join us and talk about their favorite episodes today. But I'll just give you a few stats behind sort of the work that's gone into Breaking Banks over the last 300 episodes, 6.5 years. Obviously, all this work that has been put in, this is what has turned Breaking Banks into the number one fintech radio show and, podcast in the world today, 180 countries, 6.5 million unique listeners. But it didn't start like that, obviously. We'll get to the origin story of the show in a little while. But just to give you some stats behind the show, given that it is our 300th episode, preparation for each show roughly takes about 3 to 6 man days of effort to produce. So we're talking about 20,000 hours of effort just to get the show out over those 6 years on a weekly production basis. Now, that does include admin and marketing, sponsorship efforts, and things like that, but that's just to produce a one-hour show and get it out. We've had over 750 guests on the show in those 300 episodes, a lot of repeat guests, as we've heard. Just to sort of give you rough numbers, we finished out the year 2013 with about 10,000 to 13,000 listeners per episode, with about 40 countries in our geographical footprint. But this year, we're averaging somewhere between 250 and 580,000 listeners per episode across 180 countries. How that breaks out, we've got roughly 100 to 200,000 listeners per episode on the Voice America syndication. We have downloads via iTunes, Google Play, Podcaster, Stitcher, and so forth, about 100,000. Chloe's baby's joining in the background. AM syndication.
Her very first podcast, Brett.
Yeah, you exactly. Know, true. Historical moment. It's the first baby we've had on the show as well. So AM syndication, roughly about 80 to 150,000 per episode. So that goes out of New Jersey and Connecticut, covering the tri-state area. Access to about 20 million listeners, across those radio band coverage. Syndication through fintech partners like American Banker, BankNext, Irish Tech News, etc. Another 10 to 20,000 downloads. So that sort of gives you a bit of a feel for some of the stats behind the traffic of Breaking Banks that goes out to 180 countries roughly on each episode. Jason?
I mean, it's crazy to me to think of all of those guest appearances, some of the notable guests that we've had, from Elon Musk, Guy Kawasaki, Bill Gates, Boris Johnson. Actually, would love to get Boris Johnson back. I've got a whole host of questions. Stephen Wolfram, Brock Pierce, Peter Diamandis, Tim O'Reilly, Dave Box, David Brin, Kevin Anderson, Ramez Nam, actually one of my absolute favorites, having IBM Watson on via Pepper. I think that is the first machine we had on the show.
It's the first AI, yes.
Yep, the first. But then we had Sophia the Robot next, and along with Ben Gertzel, her creator, Vitalik Buterin, Joe Lubin, Chris Larson, Bob Pisani from CNBC. I mean, the list just goes on of notable guests. It's one of my favorite reasons for doing the show. Now, we've also had some pretty interesting companies, you know, from startups to some of the biggest players.
Yeah, Chloe here. So we've obviously had the machines, we've had the robots, and now we've got our first baby, my seven-week-old Louise is in my arms as I'm hosting here. So Louise on Breaking Banks, youngest co-host of Breaking Banks ever. She's fast asleep but secretly loving it. But yeah, on to those companies. There have been some amazing ones. Simple, Fidor, Monzo, N26, Revolut, they went through quite a lot. That was interesting to talk about at the time. Klarna, company I've done a bit of work with, Ripple, TransferWise, Currency Cloud, Zinja, Atom, Starling, Square, Venmo, Clinic, Chime, Zopa, Lending Club. I've got to take a breath now. Ant Financial, WeBank, and some really big large players. We've obviously had all the major banks on, a lot of the big major researchers, and we've had the likes of Finastra, IBM, Amazon, Bain, Citi, Capital One, also went through some interesting times recently, AARP, and Techstars. As I said, the list could go on and on, but it's been amazing. I started co-hosting with you, Brett, at the start of this year, which was really exciting, but I'd been an avid listener of Breaking Banks before then, and it's a fun show. We always have a great time, and happy 300th birthday, by the way. You're looking happy pretty good for 300.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, the show actually started as a bit of a lark, but you guys, you know, if you've been following my writing career, I started off writing, obviously, Bank 2.0 back in 2009. It was published in 2010, followed it up with Branch Today, Gone Tomorrow. And then, you know, as Movin, my own startup that we were kicking off in 2011, Alex Cyan and myself, as that started to get some traction, it became harder and harder for me to do sort of a weekly blog or two or three blogs a week, which is the sort of stuff that Jim Maroos and Chris Skinner still are able to churn out. But I found running Movin, it was just it was too much. So I had the idea after I went on a radio show in California. I was contacted by a producer out there, and he said, "You should do a radio show. You should do a podcast." And in my thinking, I was thinking, look, you know, it's going to be easier to do an hour a week on a podcast than the 3 or 4 hours it would take me to put together a solid blog post or article. So I was thinking it was going to save me time. I really had no idea it was going to turn into this monster thing that we've got. So, you know, we started the show back in 2013. Obviously, today it's a very different team. We've created now a media company structured around the various podcasts that we produce. That's called Provoke Media. Provoke.fm is the website address for that. We did a Breaking Banks Asia Pacific spin-off. We had the FinTech Five with Jason and Sam Moore have hosted. We have a Serial Entrepreneur, which JP has done. Ron has been a regular with his Snark Tank on the show. Jim's been a regular. There's been a bunch of this stuff. But the big news, you know, is we're now starting to help others produce their own podcasts. So you're going to hear about some big news around that, like Finovate, who we're going to be producing their podcast for them. So Provoke Media is really starting to become this. It's sort of the gimlet of fintech. I don't know if you know Gimlet Media, do you, Chloe?
Yeah.
JP, why don't you take us through some of the guests who are going to join us on the show today?
Sure. As Chloe said, the list does go on and on. So in addition to Brad and Chloe and Jason on with me today, our old friend Jim Maroos is joining us. Chris Skinner is calling in. John Best, Theo Lau. So some of our favorite regular contributors are going to join us here today, and we're going to talk about some of our favorite moments over those past 300 episodes. I remember my first guest appearance was in 2013. The show was pretty new, and we had just created what was then called the Bank Innovators Council. We had this idea
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, this crazy idea that banks might want to work together. Fast forward a few years and a very effective partner in Jason, we have, of course, now launched the Alloy Labs Alliance, pushing on 40 members now who are collaborating and sharing costs and risk, and maybe just importantly, sharing the learnings with one another. I first hosted on in December of 2015, and I remember thinking, how do you keep this going the whole time? You've got all of these things to go on, the different guests and questions, but at the same time, you're trying to watch the clock and everything. So I'm still waiting for that time where this saves you time, Brett, as you said. So, but one of our favorite regular guests, I think for all of us, has been Dave Birch. He joins the show regularly, and he couldn't be on this week's show live, but we do have a clip from his appearance on September 23rd, 2016, on the show that we called Cardmageddon. That was all about the demise of plastic credit cards. But first, we had a news story about the massive breach at Yahoo. And Dave found an aspect of that quite shocking. Let's play the clip.
Could you play the clip, Matt?
Dave, did you see the news about Yahoo, the breach about Yahoo?
I was absolutely astonished. But I mean, I was flabbergasted. I mean, to say that's an understatement. I was absolutely amazed. I had no idea that Yahoo had 500 million accounts. But the good news is they might know my password now. So at least, you know, somewhere out on WikiLeaks, I'll find my password and I'll be able to log back in.
Now, one of the reasons I chose that moment, guys, is I thought that was one of the funniest unscripted moments we'd had early in the show with Dave Bush. Back in 2015, of course. It's, but that was just a classic. How Dave, his sense of humor, his dry sense of humor, and how he got in. Chris Skinner has joined us all the way from Poland.
Dzień dobry, Brett.
Yeah. Now, Chris and I used to co-host a lot of shows in those early days before he became world famous and traveling all around the world. But Chris, tell us about some of your recollections of hosting the show and some of your favorites.
Well, you know, I mean, it's been quite a while now, and I've been blogging every day, but podcasts and vlogs and other media is also a great way to air and reach people. And so I guess my main memories are, you know, when we were talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin, and all the things to do with banking as a service and APIs, people kind of didn't really know what the hell we were talking about, and now they do.
Absolutely. Now,
Chris.
We've got so many on today. So, Chris, I'm going to play a clip from Brock Pierce later in the show, but one of the shows that one of the things that you've always been a big fan of championing is what's happening with the UK challenges. We did a show back in September 6, 2018, and a couple of your pals were on that show, Tom Blomfield and Ann Bowden. So I thought we'd play a clip from that show, if that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of everything globally to do with fintech, but obviously championing the British cause because that's where I come from. And it is the capital of fintech in London, so that's why Starling and Monzo are based there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Matt, if you can play us clip number 3 with Tom from Monzo.
So we were all actually at Starling to start with, which is interesting. You've got Anne on it. I'm sure she'll be happy to talk about it. But we moved on from there and set up Monzo in February 2015. That's when we incorporated the company. And then we launched our first product to customers in about November of that year, back in 2015. And the first product was just a prepaid card. It was really a prototype of a bank. So our intention wasn't ever to kind of market a prepaid card as a standalone financial product. It was more like the fastest way we could prototype a checking account. And so, you know, when you say prepaid card, immediately there's kind of preconceptions of subprime customers or less affluent customers or kids or you know, people who are new to the country kind of spring to mind. And although we certainly have been using our product, it was really targeted at the mainstream. It was just a way to get something launched super fast.
So that was Tom Blomfield. So I don't know whether you guys knew that, but Tom and the core team for Monzo actually came out of Starling. I don't know. Is that controversial? JP, what do you think?
Well,
it was a bit controversial.
Yeah.
I sat next to Tom at a dinner once. I think it was a bit controversial at the time.
Yeah.
One of Chris's, actually. Yeah.
Well, this is the way it works, right? People move from one thing to another, and that's part of why the fintech community is so tight. We all know each other, and probably good chance we've worked with one another at some point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, there's still a huge lineup for the Monzo card.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's still a hype around that. People are still waiting. I saw someone post the other day about it, being excited to have got one. So they're still on that wave.
Absolutely. I want to ask Jim in a moment to join us and talk about his favorite clip. But before that, let's hear also from that show on the UK Challenges from Anne Bowden. She was on the show on September 6th last year talking about starlings growth. So, Matt, could you play clip number four, please?
One of the things that is, of course, interesting to sort of think about is the sort of structural changes that's happening around markets and so forth. And obviously, the shift towards challenger banks, we are starting to see quite a bit of traction in the UK. Some of the challenger banks like yourselves, Monzo, Revolut, really, really getting some traction. So tell me, first of all, give us an update of where Starling is at.
Yeah, well, we're sort of 4 years into our journey now, and things are really very, very exciting. We have a quite a powerful retail consumer business. We are doing well on our business accounts, and these are our really B2C offerings. We also have a marketplace which is up and running, where we provide insurance, loyalty, asset management, wealth management products, mortgages, to the same customer base. And because we built our technology from scratch and we have direct access into payment schemes, we've opened up our infrastructure to other fintechs, other banks, and other organizations. And those businesses are really feeding from each other. Each gives something to the other in some sort of way. We are very proud in that we are now offering our infrastructure services, our banking as a service, our platform services to large organizations and fintechs. We recently talked about our RBS proposition.
I saw that announcement. So you guys are, obviously RBS as an incumbent in the market. Has fallen a little behind in terms of particularly, CX, the user experience.
So, Anne is one of my favorite guests as well. She actually was one of my first interviews for the Serial Entrepreneur, and I really got to do a deep dive with her, all about her story. Really one of the first senior women in tech in London a very long time ago. So cool to see her story. Well, Jim Arus is another one of our favorite guests and regular contributors. And Jim, you want to talk a little bit about your experience and introduce your favorite clip?
Yeah, today's kind of monumentary in that, I think about the fact that over the last 5 years, 300 shows, Brett has pronounced my name right, actually the first time today.
Marouse, not Morales.
Isn't it Morales?
It is amazing because of Brett, because of the wide distribution, it is amazing how many times I get introduced at webinars and at events,
and
they pronounce it the way Brett pronounces it. But the good news is we fought, there was one time when they called me Jim Morale and Jim Maru, and they what's interesting is every pronunciation brought its own theory on where I was based. Am I French? Am I Bohemian? Whatever it is. So this
see,
is
I pull
good.
That with
it's
JP, awful. Jim. I can swear that stands for anything from Juan Pablo to Johann Peter.
What's funny too is that this also is the episode that we will have the youngest and the oldest participants in, that Louise is obviously the youngest and I am the oldest. So
isn't Chris older than you?
He's not on to defend
himself.
He's not
to defend himself.
Fair,
he's
Brett.
Dropped off now.
Anyway, I think we agreed that Brett was 300, argue. So he's the oldest.
Yeah.
It's also interesting in that the Breaking Banks podcast actually started the same year that I started writing formally for the Financial Brand. And so the correlation was not lost in the fact that a lot of times we talk about things that that we handle the Financial Brand and vice versa. And it's been a great partnership with Brett and the whole team of people that introduced the show. And I it's not my favorite episode because it brings with it some anxiety at times, but I'll never forget the first show that I guest hosted. So Brett was going to be out of the country and he gave me a call and said, "Hey, would you like to guest host the show?" And I said, "What are the dynamics?" He said, "Okay, here's how you do it." And being the first time I had done this, I decided I really should put together a real tight agenda and a tight script. script and everything was going to go good. We were going to have two guests on the show. Everything was going great until we got online. And within 1 minute of me going through my script and talking to the first guest went offline. And it happens once in a while. It's the things you know, if you're brand new to it, you don't know what to do exactly. Brett obviously does it in his sleep at times, but the reality is it startled me. And so all of a sudden I'm going along my highly formal script and saying, geez, where do I go next? Oh, that's right. I'm going to go to my second guest. Well, then I thought I had it all handled. And so the first guest rejoined us. And what ended up happening, and it's the beauty of live, and it's also the beauty of being able to ad lib and not miss a beat, is the fact that it was the show that we went from being two individual guests to making it three guests or two guests and myself having a discussion online. And it was a blast. It really worked out well, but it was one of those things that when you do your first one, you think you got it all nailed down, and you go, yeah, you got to realize that not everything goes perfectly all the time. But, when I think about my first episode, the episode that I enjoyed the most, it's actually one that I participated in a live scenario. Brett had Josh Reich from Simple. He interviewed him at the Financial Brand Forum, our Financial Brand Forum in 2015. Yeah. And what was interesting about that show and fun about that show was it's what happens, and it's not the only time it's happened. It happens quite a bit with Brett because he has so many connections, is that the personal humor between guest and host, in this case, comes out. And while I was on the beginning of that show, it quickly went out of control from the standpoint of great content to the point that Josh and Brett, in their dialogue, it became very clear that they no longer remembered they were on radio, to the point that if we had a censor at that time, Josh would have been censored, because I believe he might have been the first person to drop a good four-letter word on the show. And what was interesting is everything was done in stride because, again, it was two friends communicating with each other. It was great to see it live because I really have a lot of respect for both the gentlemen that started the first fintech banks in the United States, I think from my perspective at least, and how they worked together but at the same time were competitors. And I thought it was great content, but it was certainly funny. And I'm sitting on the sideline going, I wonder if they just realized what just happened. And I think it took Brett for a while to realize that, oh, geez, I think we might have just broken some FCC laws. But
Well, let's play the clip, and I'll attempt to censor Josh. So, Matt, play us clip number two.
How do you like living in Portland? You talked a little bit about Portland today and what it's like, because you started, of course, Simple. You started as you said today, in your basement
in New York.
In New York,
yep.
And then you made the move to move. You made the move out to Portland. So how's that been for you?
You know, I think I made the mistake when I first moved to Portland of trying to replicate the New York lifestyle. I like the New York lifestyle, so I lived downtown. Portland is not New York. About a year ago, coincidentally, I moved out to the hills. On my drive in each morning, I see horses and cows. I go to sleep to the sounds of coyotes. It's a very Portland experience, and I love it. It is just great. I'm like 15 minutes away from the office, but I'm living in the wilderness, which is gorgeous.
And you actually got some signage up on your office recently.
Yeah, it's like a real business now. Yeah, we have the Simple logo.
How many staff do you have now? Can you talk about
something
it?
Over 200.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because you were like 90 when you got acquired, right?
Yeah.
It was about that. So that's big. That's great.
We've been growing.
That's fantastic. Yeah. What do you do with all those people?
Let them do magical things and let them make great products.
You're sounding more and more like a real bank every day, man.
Shit. Maybe.
We are live on the AM band, by the way, but that's okay. I think we get away with that.
So we did get away with it, Jim, didn't we? Sort of, almost. Chloe, I understand you're going to drop off with Bub.
Yeah,
so
I've got to drop off. I loved that comment there from Josh. Trust an Aussie to be the one to drop that in on that at the Financial Brand Forum in Vegas. So I'm going to drop off, but I just wanted to say, such a great, obviously, 300 episodes, and looking forward to what's next, Brett. I mean, what you've created is absolutely awesome, and it's a pleasure to be involved with it with all of you. So enjoy the rest of the show.
Thanks, CJ. See you, Louise.
Bye.
Brett, I've got to take a little bit of exception with Mr. Morouse there, that just like the record to show.
Morouse.
No, Morouse. that it is Perk Street actually predated both Movin' and Simple by, I believe it was 6 and 9 months respectively. But that does mean the first three challenger banks in the U.S. all now regularly appear on the show, which is pretty funny. And you know, you know, and that's how we got to know each other back in the day. And you wrote that Breaking Banks, and it became like the Bible around Perk Street. And as I was reflecting on, you know, being on the show, you know, better than the favorite episode, I started with what I think was one of the funniest moments. JP, do you remember when you and I were co-hosting? We had David Birch on, and he was looking for a pen and paper, which we didn't know at the time, but all we could hear was that zipper.
Yes. Opening and closing back and forth. And we finally said,
"Dave, what are you doing?
I'm looking for a pen." I said, "Thank God."
And meanwhile,
well,
like,
still isn't a good answer, by the way.
It wasn't a good answer, but we had all these images of all of the things that in the crazy David Birch world could actually be going on in the background, which was a bit crazy. But when it gets to favorite episodes, you know, mine was a tie between Chris Skinner and I were going to talk about the neobanks. And I came in loaded for bear, and I was so excited to spar with Chris on this. And he, like, totally caught me off guard that we, like, quickly agreed that, you know, in 2008 it was so novel and it was actually a real strategy to be, you know, a digital bank. And, you know, fast forward 10 years and it's actually now table stakes. And Jim, kind of like you, it's like, you just ruined all my show notes. We were about to spar over this and you just agreed with me. What am I supposed to do now? So I'm not going to play that clip, but the one I like even better is Matt Harris from Bain, who is one of the first very focused on fintech VCs before fintech was super fashionable and, you know, has now become really an icon in the industry. But in typical Matt fashion, the conversation started with him on a New York street corner waiting for an Uber to LaGuardia.
That's so nice.
I couldn't have penned it better. And so I'd love to play this clip as we talked about funding fintech's future.
All right, play clip number five, please, Matt.
So I sort of got the fintech bug very early in my career. And then at Village, I did a couple early financial technology investments, as you point out, among a number of things I was doing. And then I just realized that if I wanted to have a serious career in venture capital, I kind of needed to stand for something. I needed to have something distinctive to hang my hat on. And to me, I thought the opportunity in financial innovation was real. And at that time, there were so few people focused on it that I kind of liked the ratio. It felt like a space where I could be one of the leaders.
And he was. He was probably the first, fintech, of note investor, probably in definitely in the U.S. I think Anthemis might have been close as sort of the first globally. I'm not sure, but
yeah. Yeah, if I think back to the Anthemis tracking, you know, they were certainly getting into it. I think Matt was the first one who really established a brand around it, that it was his sole focus and was doing it at scale. You know, there are other VCs, you know, even when I was a VC, I did things that, you know, touched in payments. But, you know, Matt really defined it and really looked at proactively, you know, where do I think the puck is going to be within fintech? And was always leading, you know, was one of the first into the alternative lending and then was one of the first out of it, was one of the first into the challenger banks, but then also recognized when the space was becoming overhyped. He's just a phenomenal person to follow in terms of his thought process.
I had Matt on a show with Betterment, with John Stein. And another famous guest. I had David S. Rose on that show as well, and it was a great conversation. That was another really classic show. But Matt really knows his stuff. I was a little jealous because Josh and Shamir managed to get Matt to invest in Simple, but because he led I think their Series A, right?
Yeah.
At that, so then he went on the board, And so because he was on the board of Simple, he couldn't invest in Movin, which was really disappointing for me. But
You and I are in the club. He actually said no to Perk Street at the time, too, because we weren't tech-heavy enough. So, you know, you and I can be in the Matt Harris turned us down club.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're going to take a break. JP, do you want to take us out to break?
Well, sure. We will be back with more Breaking Banks right after this.
This episode of Breaking Banks is sponsored by a great podcast called The Meb Faber Show. The Wall Street Journal named it one of the top five investing podcasts you should not miss. If you're looking to learn from the brightest minds in finance, or you simply want to know more about investing in a casual and fun interview format, it's a must show to listen to. The show's hosted by Meb Faber. He's the CEO of Cambria Investments and an award-winning ETF manager. The goal of his show is to help you grow and preserve your wealth by giving you new investing insights and ideas. Check out the Meb Faber Show wherever you enjoy your podcast. That's Meb, M-E-B, Faber, F-A-B-E-R. You don't want to miss it.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. And if you missed the first half, we are partway through, so call it, this is the 300 and a half episode that we're talking about all the great guests that we've had on. And, you know, one of my favorite parts is the people you get to meet and interact with and some of those relationships and friendships. As JP said, you know, it's kind of a small circle. And so I got to know Theo Lau when she asked me to help with AARP and their FinTech Advisory Board. Now, I want to point out, earlier this morning, Theo outed me on Twitter because we did an episode on aging not that long ago, and I made the comment with sarcasm dripping that, you know, everyone knows that old people don't know how to use technology. Only millennials know how to use technology, right? And so Theo very kindly extracted that as the clip for her to retweet. And I've gotten nothing but hate mail since then. So thank you very much, Theo.
You're very welcome, my friend.
Yeah.
Well, I just want you guys to know, I mastered AOL and I stayed on AOL. So I reject that comment, too. Oh, wait, AOL. Not a good thing.
Jim's password is totally secure on AOL.
Yeah. Right. Jim's password is your password. Password? We should totally try that.
Oh, it's password 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Sorry, Jason, but come on, you know that. It when I was listening to it, I was just screaming to be acknowledged. So it was fun. Sorry.
Oh, got the conversation going.
Was that your favorite episode, Theo?
No, actually, I had many favorite episodes, but my other favorite one was also with Jason, where he called the episode Banking's Anti-Aging Cream, and I have to say I had a little bit bone picking with that title. But regardless, I love the content because it is a topic that is near and dear to me, FinTech for Older Adults. And also, I think it was the first episode I did with Heather from Genuvity, and I love her work. I've been following her for quite a few years, and also Marcy, which Jason, I know you love. And also it's the first episode I ever did with Brad, who then became my partner in crime. So it was a memorable moment.
Yeah, Brad's been on the show quite a few times. You know, I had trouble getting him on the show, though. He didn't want to be on the show early on in the piece, so he was, I don't know, he was nervous or what. Maybe it was his...
days, I guess. For part of that time, right, Brad Limer was a bank employee, and he had to go through all kinds of hoops to get approval.
I used to get his name wrong all the time. I used to say Lima.
Don't you still call him Lemur? I heard a lot of people call him that still.
Yeah, well, I didn't know it was Lima until he was coming on the show and corrected my pronunciation. So,
All the people to mispronounce, we can have. We'll start a private equity firm, Lima and Morales and partner.
Oh, that's fun! But I have to say though, happy birthday! It's an amazing milestone, 300 shows, and you know more 300 to come. And I'd say you actually inspired a lot of the work that we do. So thank you, Brad.
I appreciate that. You know, in fact, I met Brad in San Francisco. At the wharf. What's the famous wharf there?
Fisherman's Wharf.
Yeah, Fisherman's Wharf.
The tourist trap.
I'm pretty sure. In fact, it was. I think it was Alex Cyan and I, and it was before we founded MoveIn. So it must have been. It must have been late 2010. I'm going to say.
That's Fisherman's Wharf. What were you shopping for? Keychains with your names on them.
No, I think we were in San Francisco maybe doing some work for Sapient Nitro at the time, I'm going to say. Maybe we were fishing around for some startup capital for MoveIn. I can't recall exactly, but I do remember that I met Brad very early on the piece. And, of course, if you look at the guests that appeared on the early shows and the hosts that we've had involved in the show since those early days, a lot of them have come from the fintech mafia. And so, you know, the fintech mafia was really a lot of the birthplace of the content for Breaking Banks over those years. And of course, we've spun off other podcasts from our alumni as well. Theo, you and Brad have your own podcast now. Of course, Sam, who was the host for FinTech 5, went off to FinTech Insiders. A lot of those guys appeared on the show early on. Vitaly Buterin, who was on the show, came on with Simon Taylor. So, you know, we did give birth to this whole FinTech podcast industry in many ways. Although technically, Dave Birch probably had the first fintech podcast because he did that. He did his 15 megabyte podcast or whatever he used to call it. He started that back in 2010, I think. But we were definitely the first radio show. We were on the AM band in 2013. So and we've been on ever since. So there's but there's a ton of history. There's a ton of history.
Speaking of the radio portion of it, Brett, earlier this year, speaking at the FDIC's Future of Banking Conference, I was talking to someone in a table in front of me. A person spun around and looked at me wild-eyed and said, "You're Jason from Breaking Banks."
I've had that.
Right. Oh, but you've got a distinctive voice in history, right? But the funny thing was, he said, "Yeah, I listen to Breaking Banks. I live in New York City. I commute to New Jersey, and I listen to Breaking Banks every Thursday on my commute. I'm working in the banking industry, and I couldn't believe I found there was a radio show dedicated to what I do. You know, sports is kind of obvious, and you know, financial services and trading, it's obvious. But little did I know, you know, here was Breaking Banks, you know, talking about my industry on the radio."
Yeah, it's funny. I've had that when I've gone to conferences and I've been sitting in the audience and lean over and talk to someone and someone does a double take because they've never met me before, but they've heard my voice. That's a bit weird to be recognized in that way. But anyway, so maybe JP, Jim, actually, maybe you could comment on this. When you're in your travels, how often do you come across people that mention the show to you?
You know, it is pretty amazing because it's one of the staples, you know, that it's kind of like the financial brand where it has an international appeal. But people, they mention, obviously, in my intro that I'm associated with Breaking Banks, and then people bring it up. And you know, it's great when you have multiple channels that people know you from. I mean, some people know me from LinkedIn, some people know me from the financial brand, but they also do mention Breaking Banks, and invariably, our connection is there, because what will happen is, I don't do a trip ever that somebody doesn't come up and say, "Hey, have you seen Brett lately?" Because you certainly have done a whole lot more international travel than I have, and the same thing happens with Chris, is that the group is often linked together quite regularly, and people, you know, connect with me to find out how others in the group are doing, which is kind of fun.
Sorry, go ahead, JP.
Oh, I was just going to say it happens quite often to me as well. Although I'll say, as the recovering banker of the group, I spend a lot of time, as you know, helping banks really innovate. And I'm catching people a lot earlier in their learning curve. So I'd like to think I'm at least minorly responsible for some of the show growth, because I'm probably the other way around. I may not have somebody know me from the show every time I speak, but I'd say every time I speak, I gain at least one new listener, because I talk about the show all the time, and people appreciate the recommendation.
Well, a shout out to Brad Lima, because he's just mentioned on Twitter that the meeting that I had with him at Fisherman's Wharf was with Mike Degnan. It wasn't with Alex Sion. So well mentioned, Brad. So, that was a few years ago. No wonder my memory, anyway. One of the other top rated shows, Jim, that you and I did, which was probably in terms of production values one of the most detailed shows we did, was also the show for M-Pesa in Kenya. Do you remember that show?
Well, I definitely do, because, you know, you don't script very often, because you just know this stuff really well. But that was one of those ones, because there's so many audio clips and all that, there was a lot of scripting to it, but it was, I had just gotten back from Kenya. So it resonated with me. You had just gotten back from a great trip to Kenya. And again, it shows the dynamic nature. I mean, I can't imagine 5 years ago having the discussions we're having nowadays about the subject matters, but also the places we've gone. It's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Bob Collymore, who was on that show, passed away recently. So, one of the key guys behind the big growth of M-Pesa. But one of the other characters that's been on the show a few times, and it was one of Chris's favorites that he mentioned earlier, but also always guaranteed to provide some good entertainment on the show, articulate. Started off as a child actor, of course, with the Mighty Ducks. This is Brock Pierce. And we had him talking, he's been on the show multiple times, talking Bitcoin, blockchain, Puerto Rico, his investments in the blockchain space. And so I thought I'd play a clip from one of Brock's appearances back in March 2016. So, Matt, could you play clip number 6, please?
Yeah, so... the blockchain I like to describe as the operating system, and Bitcoin was the first application. You now have about 650, maybe 700 blockchains in the world that are all, you know, modified or slightly different from Bitcoin in some way, or perhaps radically different, and they with different attributes. In the case of Bitcoin, it's got about 80% of the called overall market share of blockchains today, and all Bitcoin's blockchain, not all of them are designed this way, are built on open source software type architecture, meaning that you've got lots of people that are developing the Bitcoin blockchain software. They're making their proposals as to what they think is the best way to scale it. And so this debate has ensued because Bitcoin is suffering from its own success. It's growing exponentially. Most people look at the price as the primary barometer of sentiment, and Bitcoin went up to $1,000. It's now trading in the low to mid 400s. And so if that's the only data point you look at, you might think that, you know, perhaps Bitcoin is failing. But if you look a layer deeper and you look at all the fundamental metrics, it's growing, you know, at 40% month over month all over the world.
Now, the reason I wanted to play that clip, guys, is Brock was talking about the valuation of Bitcoin being at $1,000 as big news. And, of course, this was back in 2016, well before Bitcoin exploded and went up to $20,000 per Bitcoin. And so, you know, we had this relationship with Bitcoin through the entire show, talking about the value of Bitcoin and what's going to happen. Jason?
You know, you could tell it jumped the shark. I had back-to-back Lyft experiences. It was, I think, really between Thanksgiving and the Christmas holiday of last year that I jumped in several lifts, and like three times in a row, and I guarantee they were not Breaking Banks listeners, that they recognized me in some form or fashion. They cared about fintech. But you knew it was a thing when your Lyft driver turns to you and says, "What do you think about the price of Bitcoin?" And it's like, what?
Absolutely. So we've had some real gems on the show in respect to Bitcoin and blockchain generally. We had Vitalik Buterin come on and talk about Ethereum, including polymorphic encryption and hash graphing and tangles and stuff like that. It was pretty insane getting into that tech. Michael J. Casey was our Bitcoin consultant. You guys remember Michael being on the show talking about blockchain and Bitcoin? He still comes on the show regularly. He's from MIT.
Brett, remember you and I were on a show on the cannabis coin, right? Since any of the growers in and around cannabis can't be accessing, even if it's legal in that state, accessing things like the ACH and getting banks in order to, be able to move money around. And they were viewing, using an ICO and coins was a way around that. Do you remember that show?
Yeah. In fact, the whole ICO thing, we sort of rode that wave as well. It's quietened down a little bit since then. But, in terms of the whole blockchain stuff, we had John Matonis on one of the very early shows. He was the chair of the Bitcoin Foundation back then. And then, of course, Brock took that title, a couple of years later. So we really have, it's very interesting. Even though Bitcoin started in 2008, it didn't sort of come into the common consciousness till 2012, 2013.
And, well, I would argue it wasn't even in the consciousness yet, right? Maybe in a thin layer of people. Yeah. But, now we've had Perianne Boring from the Digital Chamber of Commerce. She's been a great guest talking about the work they're doing in Washington around, working with regulators and lawmakers and really trying to do this idea of how do you do innovation and do it safely.
Yeah, well, one of the things that when we talk about innovation and we talk about future-proofing, obviously we had a lot of artificial intelligence stuff talking on the show. We had the author of that book, The Last Invention, I think it's called, or Our Final Invention, James Barrett, on the show talking about AI. We had, but I really loved the sci-fi guys that would come on the show. That was always the highlight for me. JP, maybe you can introduce another guest and co-host that's been on the show regularly that also was on some of those discussions.
Sure. Well, that would be John Best from BIG, Best Innovation Group. John, welcome back to the show. Talk a little bit about some of the technology that you have been focused on the show and off the show. We may have lost John. Well, I know one of the things that he wanted to talk about, Brett, was David Brin talking about competitive AI. So could we play clip number 7?
And one of the interesting concepts that you introduced, David, was the fact that one of the potential mechanisms for protecting us from a sort of runaway AI intelligence is maybe competitive AIs. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yes. Well, Hollywood needs to put heroes in jeopardy. And so it all too often goes for simple failure modes. And it's good to warn about those. I mean, some AI that, suddenly comes awake and wants to destroy all humans. Well, all right. We've been warned about that, to watch out for it. And if everything's done in the open, we will watch out for that. But in the long run, if they're going to be smarter than us, then if we try to control them rigidly, like with Asimov's laws of robotics, well, the only thing that'll happen is that they'll become lawyers and they'll be able to manipulate the laws any way they like. So the long-run solution to preventing domineering, overwhelming, godlike AIs from, creating a dystopia and oppressing us is to remember what caused dystopias and oppression in the past. 99% of human societies in the past were oppressive dystopias. They were shaped like a pyramid with a narrow ruling class at the top, a king a bunch of lords who had swords and enforced the king's will, priests who yammered at everybody that this was a good thing that the king's sons would own your sons and daughters. And we found a way out of this. And the way out was flatten everything so that no matter who you are and what an aristocrat you are, no matter how great you are or how rich you are or politically connected or how smart you are, you can't evade criticism. Reciprocal, flat, competitive criticism. And that's the core of our five great arenas. Those arenas are markets, which create products, the greatest wealth the world's ever seen, because big companies and individuals compete with each other. Democracy. We've had, you know, horrible effects in democracy, but overall, gradual improvements in policy, because good policies survive, bad policies die competitively. Courts are competitive. Science is competitive. And the last arena is sports. And in all of these cases, if you prevent cheating, then you get the benefits of competition. Well, why not extend this to AI? We fear any one AI becoming a lord, just like those lords in our past. It frustrates me that nobody's pointing out that the thing we fear AI doing is the same thing we fear Big Brother doing, the same thing we fear a king doing, the same thing we rebelled against with King George and his lords. And the solution is the same.
Well, John Best, I think we have you back on the line now, and I'd love your thoughts on David Brin's comments, but also your view on the kinds of technologies you think have been changing the world and will be changing the world as we go forward.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's an honor to be on the 300th episode. I just tweeted out that when you were talking about podcasts that got spawned off, mine was actually one, and Brett was gracious enough to be on the first episode, and we continue today and have a whole lot of episodes out there, so thank you for that, Brett. And, I've been on a lot of these episodes where we've talked about things that are really future-related. We had a great episode with Kevin J. Anderson, Ross Dawson, Katie King, talking about science fiction and the future of money. And it was a very interesting contribution. We talked a lot about what happens when you finally get to Mars, and I love the outside thinking that we had there. As I listened to Brin, I see a lot of points that are sort of driving this AI towards a more personable kind of entity. And, you know, I think before we get there, it's going to be difficult to pull together this all-knowing, all-seeing, all-understanding AI. And where I think we are today as we move forward is taking things like watching, you listen to, there was an episode that where you had David Brin on, and we talked about the idea that the AI can learn not just from one phone call, but from all the phone calls in a bank or a credit union. And the idea that it can also learn from the best of the best in the organization, I think that's the beginning of sort of this idea of AI helping the market and where it's going to go. I think to get to the next level, which I believe is what he's talking about, we're going to have to kind of go on to some higher processing power, which we had an episode about that as well, which was really cool. Where we talked about quantum computing. As a matter of fact, I just recently
had... That's right. That was a great episode, yeah.
Yeah, and we had IBM's Jeff Wessler. We talked about quantum computing, and he was surprisingly very open because, as you know, quantum computing is actually considered almost a weapon. You've got the state actors racing for getting this in place because it'll break so much encryption. But it also is going to have value in the AI space, as he mentioned as well, and how that will evolve. So I think that if I'm looking out into the future, that the technologies that I see evolving are going to be decentralization, whether it be by, blockchain technology as sort of the name that we use for it, which is really distributed ledger. It won't really be around blockchain. I like the early one, tangles and all the different technologies for that, but really they're kind of all lumped into that distributed ledger, decentralized processing. So things like just recently happened with Capital One would be very difficult to do if that was decentralized as opposed to all being on AWS. I think the decentralization is going to lead to more openness and more communication and more commerce between the international banks see that flat income around foreign exchange. You've seen some of that already with the JP Morgan coin and what they're trying to do. And then you mix in AI, its ability to learn from these transactions, and you mix in the idea of quantum, over the next 10 years. By the way, Roger Grimes' supremacy is only 2 months away, so pretty crazy.
John, I really appreciate that feedback. You know, for me, I always love geeking out with the sci-fi guys. Kevin J. Anderson and Harry Klaw was one of my favorite episodes in the last 12 months. Actually, it's about the last 12 months. But probably one of my favorite early on was Ramez Nam. Mez at the time had just he was a new sci-fi author. We'd met through the technology stuff, an ex-Microsoft guy. I love geeking out at the sci-fi stuff. Well, listen, guys, that's about the show today. We've got about a minute left before we wrap up. So, John, thanks for joining us and getting back on. Theo, thanks for again hosting and joining us. I appreciate that.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And to my comrades in arms, JP and Jason, thanks for bailing me out when I've been on planes and traveling around the world. And you guys have done a phenomenal job as co-hosts over the last couple of years and taken Provoke Media to the next level. So I really appreciate that. For you guys that are listening out there, don't forget, we have had 300 episodes, and so there's a ton of content there for you to check out. You can go to breakingbanks.com. You can look at our back catalog of episodes. Jim just came up with a great idea for me to do a post on the top 10 episodes. I think I'll definitely do that. Thanks, Jim. It's a great suggestion. But if you can do us a favor, tweet us out. Go to iTunes, where it is you download, give us a 5-star review, tell other people about the podcast. It's how we grow and how we support the sponsorship, which is keeps the show running as it has for the last 300 episodes. That's it for the 300th episode today. Thank you all for being the guests and following this journey we've had over the last 6.5 years. But that's it for Breaking Banks today. We will see you again, of course, next week on Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.